So yes, this will be a bit of a ramble through different topics. So apologize for any slight incoherence. It's mostly mine. As you can see, I spend a lot of money on title slides. Okay, so quantum information theory. Quantum mechanics is a remarkable theory. It's one of the two foundations of modern physics, and yet many people find it deeply unsatisfactory, or at least deeply disturbing, and certainly profoundly interesting, because even 80 years after being essentially written down in its complete form, it continues to surprise us. We still continue to stumble across counterintuitive results. I mean, for example, in 1994, a full 60 years-ish, more than 60 years after quantum mechanics is formulated, suddenly people discovered this thing called quantum teleportation, where they can teleport quantum information. Now, why wasn't that obvious from the start? It's all very well having a theory that's deeply counterintuitive. It makes life lots of fun, and it gets you lots of PRLs, because you can always publish yet another result saying, isn't this surprising? But sooner or later, if you want to admit that you're making progress, you'd like to develop some real physical intuition about the way reality works, about the way your theory works, so that you don't get any more PRLs where the word surprising appears three times in the introduction, so that you actually feel that you, well, at least you can convince yourself in your wildest dreams that perhaps you understand something deeper about the nature of reality. So quantum information is really, on the very basic level, just an attempt to form that kind of intuition. It's a project to form that kind of intuition, to grow it, really, out of this simple observation that the language of quantum mechanics really is just the language of information theory. And that's true on a trite level, because it talks in the same terms. It talks in terms of probabilities and in terms of the expectation values of certain events. But also it's true on a very deep level for physics in general, that we should expect profound physical theories to have a very rich information theoretic structure. Because as physicists, the whole business of studying the world involves measuring it, extracting information from physical systems, running simulations to predict their future behavior, or trying to gauge what's going to happen next, trying to retrodict what happened in the past. And those are all information processing tasks. And as soon as there's the slightest hint in quantum mechanics that actually measuring quantum systems, fundamental physical systems, is not trivial, that just as you act on it, it's going to act back on you and everything's going to be affected. Just as that becomes non-trivial, you should expect all your fundamental physics to need to refer to physical information and to treat in a detailed way how it's going to behave whilst you move along. Now, there are fringe benefits to trying to form a deep and profound intuition of the way quantum mechanics works. One fringe benefit is you get to prove counterintuitive results every now and then, because as you form your intuition, you discover new things. So you occasionally surprise yourself and manage to prove theorems which in your new language seem really simple, such as the no-cloning theorem. If you get really lucky, you actually discover things, not things that you can't do, but fun things that you can do. New and interesting tasks like teleportation, which impress people. And if you get really, really lucky, you can discover new and important things that you can do that multinational corporations and secretive government agencies want to fund in a big way. And if you can do the last two, then perhaps you have the makings of a field to work in. So what I'm going to do in this talk is just start by running through some of the mathematical basics. It may be familiar to many of you, but just to build a platform on which to talk. The mathematical basics for the language of quantum information theory. And then I'm going to go on to discuss some of these features of the theory. And try and show how they arise and what they're all about. And we'll see where we get to in 50 minutes' time. Okay, so the mathematical structure of the theory. Quantum states. Usually we get introduced to quantum states as wave functions for the position of a particle. where the amplitude of the wave function tells you how likely the particle is to be in that particular region of space-time. And that's all very good and very important. But quantum information theorists have managed to convince people that actually we don't need to bother with all that infinite dimensional stuff most of the time. We can get away with looking at finite dimensional Hilbert spaces and just concentrating on finitely large matrix behavior for the most part. And we can still get lots and lots of interesting fundamental physics out. So that's a bit of a con. They also managed to convince us of something even more profound, which is we can just stare at two-dimensional quantum systems and learn a great deal. In fact, the ultimate claim is that quantum computation allows you to do universal quantum computation solely using as your basis systems two-qubit systems, qubit systems, and interactions between two-qubit systems. So I'm just going to introduce quantum states for concreteness in one Hilbert space, namely a two-dimensional Hilbert space, and we'll go from there. Pure quantum states are just vectors in a two-dimensional complex space. They have complex coefficients, alpha and beta, just like the amplitudes of a wave function. So the probability of finding a state in the condition zero would be alpha squared, essentially, the magnitude of alpha squared. Probability of finding it in state one is beta squared. These states can describe any kind of two-level quantum system, such as the polarization state of a photon, the spin state of an electron, things like that. And these really are just vectors in complex space, satisfying some kind of normalization restriction, if you worry about that kind of thing. Actually, we can rewrite this state in this form, which reveals this global phase in front. And if you think about the way the probabilities are going to work here, when we just concentrate on the amplitude squares of these numbers, this global phase is completely irrelevant to the physical behavior of this state. It doesn't tell us anything about what's going to happen in either eventuality. So this is actually unimportant. And if we want to get technical about it, quantum states are actually just rays in Hilbert space rather than vectors. This number in front doesn't matter. But this does matter. And this is very strongly suggestive that we can describe the state of a two-level system using angles, theta and phi. And hence we have this, which I don't know if you can see over there. Don't worry if you can't. This, which is the Bloch sphere picture. This is just a simple representation. The surface of this sphere represents all pure states, pure quantum states. And opposite poles of the sphere represent the complementary eigenstates of a physical simple physical observable. So, for example, opposite poles 0 and 1 here might represent finding the electron in its spin state up in the z direction or down in the z direction. Ashwin, you couldn't get me a glass of water, could you? Thanks. Okay, so those are the pure quantum states. What about observables? If we want to talk about information theory, we really want to talk about what we can learn and what we can measure, what information we can get out. Observables are just 2x2 self-adjoint matrices. In other words, Hermitian matrices, equal to their own transpose, conjugate transpose. In the space of two-dimensional matrices. So these are the Pauli matrices. These are an example of some observables. For example, this is sigma z Pauli matrix. It really just represents, it looks at the state, and if it finds it in the zero state, it just returns the value 1. And if it finds it in the 1 state, it'll return the value minus 1. That's basically what that observable does. These observables do exactly the same thing, but in other basis directions. So, for example, z direction, x direction, y direction, spin. And they have these eigenvectors and values. But this gives us a much nicer picture, much nicer way to understand the Bloch sphere in information theoretic terms. The Bloch sphere is really just the convex set of all allowed expectation values of these observables. Or, in fact, any basis, any complete basis of observables for the quantum system. So here you see that we can have a quantum state such that we know for sure the outcome of this observable is going to be plus one. That's this quantum state. But the fact that we're in that state means that we're not going to have a clue what the outcomes of these two states are going to be. So the outcomes are going to be plus one and minus one, the probability 1/2. So the expectation values will be zero. And if you look at the entire set of pure states, and the properties their expectation values can have, they form the surface of a unit sphere in this three-dimensional real space. Which begs the question, if that's the limit of what's physically possible, what's physically allowed of us to expect the limits of our expectation for what physical systems are going to do, what about the center of the system? Because physical systems don't have to perform at this extreme limit all the time. And that's where mixed states come in. So mixed quantum states, you can think of simply as convex sums of pure states. They're the kind of state you get if you would think you had. They represent the information you'd have about the state if I told you, well, I'm giving you the pure state psi, but only with probability A. I might be giving you the pure state phi instead with probability B, and so on and so forth. And by linearity, that actually you can just turn that into a set of expectations for what's going to happen next. And those expectations are represented by a density matrix. So it's just a matrix, just like the observables. In fact, it's a subset of it's a Hermitian matrix like the observables, but they must be trace one. The trace is essentially the probability that something happens out of an exhaustive list of possibilities. So if it's real, it kind of must exist. It must be trace one. Something must happen when you ask a question of it. They also have to be positive semi-definite to be real. So this is the simplest possible density matrix. It's the maximally mixed state. It represents the very center of that sphere. It's a state of complete confusion as to what's going to happen next, because the outcome of any observable is entirely random. So there's one final thing. I'm going to skip past this for now and just talk about general operations. These are the most general form of quantum states, the most general kind of information you can have about a physical system. What's the most general thing you can do to a physical system? Well, you can hit it with a sledgehammer, or you can tweak it with a magnet, or do anything. But whatever you do, it's going to take a quantum state. It's going to take some set of data about the state and transform it into another set of data about the system, possibly even a system of different dimension. But it's going to take physical states to physical states. That's what physics is about. It's going to take predictions to predictions. So that's what a general corporation does. It's just a map that takes density matrices, essentially two density matrices. There's a slight constraint, though, because quantum mechanics is probabilistic. So rather than just simply mapping from density matrices to density matrices, we have to also consider that that operation will only occur with a certain probability. And the way we write that is that we have a map E from density matrices to other matrices, with such that the probability of it occurring is equal to the trace of the output. And the key properties of these general quantum operations are three, really. They've got to be trace non-increasing. That's just to make sure that, you know, you put a trace one state in, you don't get a trace greater than one state out. Just the basic rules of probability tell you it has to be trace non-increasing. Otherwise, you won't get physical states out. It has to be linear. Quantum mechanics is linear. They have to be positive, because they have to take all, no matter what kind of input you put in, you've got to get a physical state out. Property of sledgehammers is, no matter what you hit with them, the product of what you hit with them is a physical state. So it's got to be positive. And the tricky thing, perhaps, is it's actually got to be completely positive, which is to say that not only has it got to take all physical states to physical states, it's also got to take all physical states to physical states if it's only acting on a subsystem of a larger quantum system. And this is actually more restrictive than simple positivity. Of course, the concern here is entanglement, ultimately, which we'll get to in a bit. So general operations are just completely positive maps. The most general form is this Krauss form here, is the sum of Krauss operators. where this relation will guarantee that they're trace non-increasing. So in general, quantum operations take this form. They have a certain probability associated with them. But there's one very important class of quantum operations that don't bother with that probability because they're deterministic, and that's quantum channels. Quantum channels are just general quantum operations with the extra proviso that they're actually fully trace preserving. They do take density matrices to density matrices. And they're particularly useful because they represent the sum total of what's going to happen when we hit something with a spade. So they can fully trace any history of evolution through life of a quantum state. So for example, if we have a piece of quantum memory and we want to know what's going to happen to that memory in 5 seconds time, well, you can model that as it's going through a channel. And the output will be something which hopefully resembles the input. Otherwise, you have a very lousy memory system. OK, so that's the mathematical basics. Now let's try and get on to some slightly more fun stuff. Non-orthogonality is key to quantum states. It's the key property of states in this sphere. And it's completely trivial, really, in this framework, because states are just vectors. And we all know that vectors can be non-orthogonal. In fact, for example, these two vectors in C2 have an inner product equal to alpha. They're two perfectly valid quantum states. But the very fact that they're not orthogonal and linearity tells us that these states are going to behave similarly a lot of the time. In fact, we can upper bound the probability that they behave differently using alpha, because at least alpha squared at the time, they're going to behave identically, regardless of what you do to them, no matter how complicated and protracted the operation is. That's a huge difference from classical physics, because classically we have states which are points in phase space, which are, in theory, arbitrarily differentiable with close investigation. In fact, because classical physics is nonlinear, then you expect after a long period of time two points arbitrarily close together in phase space to diverge dramatically. Not so in quantum theory. And directly from this, we get the familiar features of quantum theory that everyone learns to start with. Uncertainty, for example, is just simply completely a reflection of this. Because the different eigenstates of observables, such as these, are not orthogonal, if we find ourselves in the eigenstate of one of these particular operators with perfect knowledge of the outcome of such an observable, we can't have knowledge of the outcome of another observable, because both of its eigenstates somewhat resemble our quantum state. So both of its eigenstates stand a good chance of pretending to exist if we were to look at that observable. So immediately from non-orthogonality, we get uncertainty. And you also obviously get measurement disturbance, because if we were then to measure this observable, we'd prepare one of these eigenstates, which is going to destroy our knowledge for the future about how this observable is going to behave. And this, in turn, will lead us directly to one of the key features of quantum information, which is that quantum information can't be copied. Quantum states simply cannot be copied perfectly. If we could copy them perfectly, then measurement without disturbance would be easy. We just create a whole slew of copies of a quantum state, and then, ignoring our original, just focus on the copies and destructively test them until we know perfectly anything we want to know about it. So clearly, intuitively, we can't copy. And here's another explanation for why we can't. It's just simply from linearity. Imagine this is a quantum cloning device. So its job is, given some unknown input and some blank state dummy on which it's going to write its output, it's supposed to produce two copies of the unknown state. How can such a box behave according to quantum mechanics? Well, at a minimum, we want it to copy the state zero, say. So we want it to take the input with a zero to two zeros. And we also want it to copy one, the orthogonal state. So we want to take this to this. But we want to copy all quantum states. So here's another quantum state, an equal superposition of 0 and 1. Ideally, we'd like to create two of these states here. But by linearity, this is just going to behave like this. The zero part is just going to evolve to this. The one part is just going to evolve to that. So instead of preparing two identical copies of our input the way we intended, we've got a lousy entangled state instead, which is quite dissimilar. You can't clone quantum information. Slightly, perhaps less famously, and this requires a bit of a philosophical, a bit of a conceptual leap, you can't delete quantum information either. People think of quantum information as being incredibly fragile, and in a sense it is, but I'm going to claim you can't delete quantum states, assuming there's no such thing as the collapse of the wave function, but come on, there probably isn't. The closest we can come to deleting quantum states is by diffusing the information away to the environment. And that's actually remarkably easy to do, unfortunately. But nevertheless, the information is still there, in theory. So if you tried to build a quantum deleting machine which took two copies to one, such as this, it would only be possible in general, because in general you can think of transformations as actually unitary operations, taking the state plus the environment to a new state plus the environment here, E. It's only actually possible if the information in here gets swapped into the environment to remain forever. May well be out of reach. It doesn't have to be stored in one particular place in the environment, for example. It can be stored in non-local correlations between multiple different parts of it. But it's known unto God. So you can't delete quantum information, unlike classical information. So what does this add up to? Well, even though it's, in a sense, permanent. I mean, first of all, so you can't copy it, you can't delete it, you can shunt it around and shift it around. This sounds like the kind of stuff we can do physics with, right? Sounds like the kind of stuff that's going to have an interesting long-term behavior in the physical world. What kind of properties does it have? Well, it is fragile in the following sense. It's valuable. If several different people want to get hold of some quantum information, some information about a quantum system, they can only do so at each other's penalty. So if we have these three people here, Alice, for example, if she learns something about this state, that's going to cost the other two's knowledge of the state. Even if they knew something already, they'll know less afterwards. And in particular, if one of these three people is actually a representation of the environment, we have something of a problem. Because if the environment becomes correlated with your system, you lose information. Now, it moves from being locally stored in your system to being scattered through the environment. And unless you want to measure the position and momentum of every air particle in the room, you may be in trouble. You probably can't do that. So this is a huge, big practical problem for people actually trying to build quantum information devices, how to somehow keep that nasty, horrible environment away from their lovely, protected system, whether by getting it cold enough or isolated enough or something like that. But it can also be a source of strength, this property. It's actually the foundation of quantum cryptography. Information is physical, right? And we've just talked about how gaining or if you gain some, someone else loses some. Gaining and losing it has noticeable physical consequences. I mean, this information represents what's going to happen next about your state, what's going to happen next about if the correlations and expectations of your state change. You know, you're going to find out about it in the long run. So here's a scenario of cryptography. Alice is trying to send some quantum information here to Bob, but there might be an eavesdropper in the middle trying to grab some of that information. Simply, we've seen, because of this kind of conservation, Eve can certainly grab the information in principle. She might be able to. But if she gets some, Bob doesn't. Eve can send replacement signals to deceive Bob, but there's no way those can be reliable copies of what she sent in the first place. Because if she holds on to some of that information, then she can't copy it and send it to Bob because there's no cloning. If she sends it on to Bob, she's just lost it again. And the point is here that Bob will know. It's noticeable to Bob that he's missing some of this information when he compares notes with Alice afterwards. When they compare notes about what they thought was going to happen, what the expectation values of their shared states were, it will be detectable whether some malign person was grabbing at their system or not, whether they actually lost that information. And obviously, if you detect that there's an eavesdropper on the line, you hang up. Now, Eve can get the message until they hang up, but in fact, for quantum cryptography, that's not actually a problem. Because they don't have to be sharing the secret message that they want to pass to one another to start with. They can actually just be establishing a private key to do one-time pad, secure one-time pad cryptography. So the message they're passing to one another is actually just a sequence of random classical bits that they're later going to use to encode a secret message. Once they have a secret one-time pad, they can publicly broadcast the message as loud as they like, and it's perfectly secure, information perfectly secure to translate, because the ciphertext could translate to literally anything of the same length. So what Alice and Bob can create between the two of them, in a sense, using quantum information, is a physically secure communication channel. They can be sure that the key, the private key they establish between themselves, is genuinely private, so long as they're confident that quantum mechanics is accurately describing their communication channel. Now, you might not be so sure of that, and that might actually be a hard sell to some bankers and government officials. But those of us in this room probably are reasonably confident that quantum mechanics is a reasonably accurate description of the physical world. So it might well apply in situations like this. And in fact, quantum cryptography is not just science fiction. It's kind of fact. There are companies that will sell you devices to do this kind of thing. Here are two of them. There are more. I think they used to set you back a few years about 50,000 a box. And you need to buy two boxes, really. Buying just one box is a bit silly. But that's kind of affordable, right? For some of us, anyway. They don't talk too much about their customer lists, but nevertheless, they are commercially available, these properties. You can do that over the phone line. You can do that publicly. Because it's essentially, you establish a private key. Or in the process of establishing your private key, you can compare notes. You can kind of sacrifice some of your instances of communication to compare notes. And so long as you randomly sample sufficiently many of the bits during the communication, you can bound the probability that Eve was detecting any information then. And you're bound to catch her. If she's trying to get a significant fraction, you're bound to catch her out at some point. And as soon as you catch her out, you say, "We give up." Okay. Yes, this tends to work with optical fiber. I mean, you can do transmission through the air. That's fine, so long as it's a detectable signal coming in, in some sense a heralded photon or a distinctive photon coming in. It's done with photons, mostly done optical fiber, over distances that in clear space transmission is now in the matter of kilometers, I think, and optical fiber about 100 kilometers. Yeah, so if you can do it 6 kilometers clear through the air, just horizontally, you can go all the way up out of the atmosphere because it's the same number of air molecules you stand the chance to hit on the way. So from, I think, bases in the Canary Islands, they're cooperating with European Space Agency to establish a secure link to the International Space Station. That'll be a lot of use. Yeah. That would be interesting. Yeah. No. The other uses of quantum cryptography, this is a bank transfer in Vienna. They've also used it from a few years ago, just the Vienna group showing off. They also used it to encrypt some transmission of election results in the recent Swiss elections. Although I somehow doubt that they're encrypting the the most vulnerable part of the Swiss election system in terms of hacks. But, you know, it's kind of fun. So the fragility of quantum information, the point is, can actually be useful. It can be a resource. Usually it's a problem. So let's move on to some other features of quantum information. Entanglement. When we tried to clone that quantum state, instead of getting two nice copies, we wound up with a silly old entangled state instead, which don't have the same properties at all. Are they at all useful? Well, yes, they are. They're fundamentally different from classical mixtures, though. That's the important point about them. A classical here you see we've got, it's just a consequence of linearity, that if those two states, just a two-particle state, either they're both spin up or they're both spin down. If that, those are physical states, then by linearity, so is this. It's just a linear superposition. So entangled states must exist. They're different from classical mixtures. They're different from having a probability 1/2 of 0, 0, and 1/2 of 1, 1. You can see that directly just by comparing the two density matrices. They're different. And in fact, the expectation values of certain measurements are different. If you measure in the spin up or down in the z direction sense, you're actually, these two states are actually very similar. They're actually identical. In both cases, half the time it says, we're both up, and half the time it says, we're both down. But when you flip the measurement direction around to something different, say spin in the x direction instead, you notice something perhaps slightly curious. The classical mixture really only has the strength to maintain its powerful correlation in one measurement direction. If you flip the spin direction, it loses all coherence. So with probably 1/4, you get all possible outcomes, up, down, down, up, the whole shebang. Pure entangled state, on the other hand, doesn't miss a beat. It just moves swiftly and smoothly into perfect correlation in this direction instead, either both up or both down. And that's kind of the feature of entanglement. Classical correlations at a distance are certainly possible. In fact, they're ubiquitous. They're the basis of a lot of physics. And the canonical example is people's socks. Despite the fact that people's feet tend to be at some considerable distance apart from one another, their socks tend to be the same color. So that shouldn't be surprising. But quantum mechanics actually allows stronger correlations, crucially, over a broader range of possible measurements on each system. Hence, and for that reason, it kind of looks spooky, as though these systems are talking to one another and must know what measurement was being performed on the other. Which brings us into non-locality, which I'm going to leave to the Foundation's crew to talk about. So, which is very, very interesting stuff, but not for this talk. The key thing for us to note for now, though, is that entanglement comes at the expense of local information. So if the overall system is in a maximally entangled state like this, the consequence for the local density matrix descriptions of individual subsystems are dire. Both local subsystems have maximally mixed density matrices. So in other words, the people holding parts of this system have no idea whatsoever what their local system is going to do next, regardless of what they do to it. There's no measurement on which they can make any kind of reliable prediction as to what it's going to do next. In fact, the entangled state contains only global information about correlations between what's going to happen next at both locations, nothing about what's locally going to happen next. And so this is the key feature of entanglement. And the reason I want to stress it is because it's going to be kind of analogous to what's how quantum computation works. The point is, we can measure global properties of systems like this, like correlation functions, directly. And if there is a cost associated with finding, with getting local predictions of what's going to happen locally, we don't have to pay it. We don't have to bother going the laborious route of achieving perfect local descriptions of what's going to happen in order to learn some global properties about the system, because we can look at entangled properties directly. So, quantum computation. So, a broader view, I mean, computing is simply a matter of computing functions. You have a function, your input to your computation is the input, and you want to calculate the function of that input, which is the output. That's computing in all its glory. Although I defer to a computer scientist. The architecture of a quantum computer is actually just perfectly analogous to that of a classical computer, or can be. We have a register of input states in some default state, say the naught state, for example, though you can kind of pick that. These are just little two-dimensional quantum systems. And then what happens is this computation goes from left to right as time progresses. We just perform logic gates on these elementary bits of information. And the logic gates just consist of unitary operations. So we perform one unitary rotation on this qubit, say, or we unitarily rotate these two qubits together, or these two qubits together. You can get universal computation, actually, from just a finite set of one and two qubit unitary operations. Just as in classical computation, you get universal computation from a finite set of logic gates. And at the end of the computation, we just measure in the measurement basis. The standard canonical basis, is it up, spin up, or spin down? Don't need to worry about measuring in any other basis. Don't even need to worry about performing non-local measurements. We can just perform local measurements on each qubit. Because if it would be better for us to perform a non-local measurement, we can just reflect that in by performing unitary transformations to reflect those states out into local canonical basis states at the end. And then some fraction of these output states outputs is going to give us the output we're interested in. It's going to tell us what we want to know. If it's a decision problem, yes or no, only one of those outputs matters. It's telling you yes or no. So here's a quick example of quantum computation. I'm going to speed up a bit, I think. We have a black box here that computes a one qubit function, a one bit function, rather. It takes either zero or one, to zero or one. And we can promise that this black box has one of two properties. Either that function is constant, either it maps zero to the same thing it maps one to, or it's balanced, i.e., you know, both values appear amongst the outputs. The question is, how many queries to the black box, assuming the black box is expensive to query, do we need to make to determine this property? Whether the black box is actually constant or balanced. This is a global property of the function, not a property of its value at any particular point. Classically, though, if you think about it, and you can think about it as long as you like, we do need two. The only way to do it is to exhaustively search, well, what's the value at zero? What's the value at one? Are they the same? So we exhaustively learn the entire function by studying the values at each local input. Quantum mechanically, we can study the global property of the function directly by means of this circuit here. This is the quantum circuit for Deutsch's algorithm, which studies this black box here. I won't describe it in detail. I'll say that the elementary operations here are just a simple rotation on the qubit space here for the H's that takes up in the Z direction to up in the X direction, and down to down in the same sense. And this is just an instance of the black box. So we have two inputs, and based on the function of the first input, we get the answer to the function encoded in the value of the second input. Just a quantum mechanical model of what the black box is doing. Essentially, what we do, we just run the computation, prepare some useful input states, send them through, and then dependent on whether the function is constant or balanced, the outputs will be orthogonal. Despite the fact that we've only run it through the black box once, we have orthogonal outputs here. If you notice that the first particle is either in the zero state or the one state. So we just perform a single measurement on the first particle, leave the second particle entirely alone, second bit entirely alone, and we output a bit. It's zero if or we get the result up if the function is constant, and down if it's balanced. In doing so, we haven't learned a thing about what the value of the function is anywhere. We just know how the values of the function relate to one another. That's the key feature. So a 2-to-1 speed up ain't that great, but it scales. That's the key thing. A more famous problem, and actually one where you don't need to have access to some mysterious black box lying around, is called factoring. It's a very simple problem. I give you an extremely large number, and I want you to tell me what its prime factors are. Every integer has a unique prime factorization. Classically, that's actually hard to do. It might sound simple, but it's genuinely hard. So hard, in fact, that it's the basis of most cryptography in use today. For instance, RSA and all internet transactions are essentially relying on it being hard for you to do this. The reason you can develop interesting schemes like RSA is that the problem has a nice structure. It's very easy to multiply two numbers together. So if I want to encrypt something, I can very easily create a large number of which I know the prime factors. But if all you have access to is that large number, it's very hard for you to translate back to what I did multiplying the numbers together. Because multiplication is easy and factoring is hard, we get cryptography. But factoring reduces to the problem of period finding. It's actually a special case of problems which can be solved, solved relatively efficiently, so long as you can solve this kind of problem. If you have a periodic function on the integers with some large period A, find A in the minimum number of queries to the integers. The reason factoring is hard is that the current state of the art for classically answering this kind of function is little better than guesswork. It really is not much better than trying numbers individually and waiting until you get lucky and find a pair that match. And that can take ages if A is huge. If the period is large, that will take forever. In fact, it takes an exponentially long time in the size of X. So that's a bit rubbish. Quantum mechanically, though, this is exactly the kind of thing, the kind of global structure of the function we can look for without bothering to find local individual values of the function at any point. And we can do that by something called the quantum Fourier transform, employing something called Shor's algorithm, which is again from 94. And using this algorithm, we can actually find the period of these periods of periodic functions on the integers efficiently in roughly this time, approximately time proportional to the natural log of n cubed. And that's much more manageable than this function, where classically we're looking at an exponential in the size of, this is the size of x, in the size of x. So this is useful. This is really why we have lots of money in the field, because as soon as you go to the NSA and say, hey, we think we might be able to read everyone's email, they get kind of excited by that. And it's actually feasible. This, for example, is this is the circuit used to compute Shor's algorithm in an NMR quantum computer. It proves a remarkable result. It proves that the prime factors of 15 are 3 and 5. Gets you a Nature paper. So it works, which is great. There's a slight concern, though, and this is the last thing I'll touch on, that 15 is all very well, but 21 might be out of reach. So yes, people will say, it all works very well in theory. What about in practice? Don't you get killed by noise? Doesn't the environment necessarily make any large quantum computation impossible? And the answer to this, the key answer to this, is a huge discovery in quantum information in the last 10, 15 years, is no, it doesn't. We can actually, quantum information is fragile, but we genuinely can protect it from noise. And the last thing I'll do is I'll just run through that to try and convince you quantum computation actually works, and it's not just a pipe dream. Classical error correction, let's just look at what you do classically first to give us an idea of what's the kind of thing that's going on. We'll encode logical bits. We just encode logical bits as redundant strings of classical bits. Why? Well, because so long as errors occur with a fairly low probability, whenever an error occurs, if we just measure all the bits, we can see that this state looks a lot like that state. It's much more likely that there was a single error with probability p than four coordinated errors, probability of order p to the power 4. So when we see something like this, we're justified in assuming, so long as p is small, we actually have this, so we can preserve this classical state. And thus we get classical repeaters that can repair signals as they get sent along. Quantum mechanically, that sounds dodgy, because we can't clone quantum information. But we can quantum error correct, and here's how. Take the quantum states 0 and 1. So we're encoding a single qubit. And we're going to encode them in 5 qubits, just like we would classically. But we're going to encode them in 2 specially chosen entangled states of 5 qubits. In fact, these code words are kind of equal superpositions of states with equal numbers of zeros. But that doesn't matter. They're just heavily entangled states in which we're going to encode these 2 numbers. Now let's let our system run forward and assume it encounters some random error. For example, let's have a random Pauli error. So I'm going to randomly perform a Pauli rotation, just a unitary, either in the x, y, or z, on one of these qubits to try and knock my system out. It's going to move the system from one state to another, take me away from my code word. But what happens? So it's taken me away from my code word, and that might have a complicated effect on the state rather than just one. But there are 15 possible Pauli errors you can have. You can x, y, or z on each qubit. And there's one operation identity which might happen. You never know. We might not actually get an error if we're lucky. So that's 16 things that can happen to one code word. There's 16 things that can happen to the other code word, too, the same 16. Makes 32 in total. And the 5-qubit space has a 2 to the power 5-dimensional Hilbert space, 32. In fact, so long as we choose our code words sensibly, it turns out that we can make sure that not only are all possible errors taking you into orthogonal states, so all possible errors are distinguishable, they keep you within the same 16-dimensional subspace, depending on whether you had code word 0 or code word 1. So all we need to do is perform a projection measurement on the state. It will report kind of the Pauli error we encountered truthfully, and we just reverse that. It's reporting the Pauli error accurately, so we don't actually need to worry about disturbing the state when we measure it, because we don't disturb the state. It's just a direct projection onto the state it already has. So we can error correct. We can get back to our original code word, even though we had a random Pauli error. But you might say that's a completely unrealistic model. Random Paulis are not the way the world behaves. What we're worried about is not people coming up and just rotating your qubits. We're worried about the environment coming and stealing your information. We're worried about qubits interacting with some cosmic ray and becoming mixed states, not preserving their purity. The remarkable thing about this Pauli protocol is it simultaneously protects you against general errors. No matter what happens to qubits, it protects you against them. Precisely because when you measure as if pretending that you had a Pauli error, you collapse the system into a Pauli error state. So in a sense, you enforce a Pauli error. And the key property of code words is that not only do Pauli errors keep you within these two distinct 16-dimensional subspaces, general errors keep you within these 16-dimensional subspaces. Even if you transform to some complicated, lousy, mixed state of 5 qubits, you still stay, because you're apparently losing information to the environment, you still stay within the same 16-dimensional subspaces. So you can reconstruct the original state perfectly and get back your perfect qubit. Yes, another way to think about it is, yes, we're allowing the environment to interact with our system, become correlated with our procedure as it goes on. But we're enforcing, by this Pauli scheme, that what the environment is getting correlated to as it gets on is the record of our error correction, not the state itself. So it thinks it's getting away with information about us, but actually it's just getting away with information we're quite happy for it to run away with about our error correction procedure. One thing we don't bother to learn is what error actually happened. We never even need to know. You can just assume it was Pauli, and we'll never be disenchanted of that. Last slide. Fault tolerance is... error correction is not enough. Preserving quantum information is all very well. You've also got to preserve it through computations as they evolve, with noisy gates and data. Gates are a problem because instead of just single qubit errors, they might actively propagate errors. Two qubit gates might create two before there was one. And the error correction operations you might be faulty. But the take-home message is, even with allowing for all these things, noisy gates, noisy qubits, imprecise measurements, error correction that's a bit dodgy, we can still compute, quantum compute, reliably, so long as we can do these three things. These two things. Design gates such that the probability of two errors coming out is of order p squared. In other words, such that there's a sense in which individual qubit errors are independent still. And second, get the probability error below a finite threshold. And so long as you... Basically, there's a two-way pull. As you error correct lots and fault tolerate lots, you actually add structure and build up your computation polynomially larger. So you're doing more stuff. If the stuff you're doing itself has an error rate that's too high, you're not helping. You're making things worse. But so long as the stuff you're doing to correct errors has an error rate sufficiently low, as you add it on and concatenate level after level of polynomially many correction operations, you're going to exponentially decrease the probability that your computation goes wrong overall. So long as you get p below a finite threshold, arbitrarily large computation becomes possible. The sky's the limit. Threshold itself is challenging, but depends very much on the architecture and the algorithm you're going to run. So that's it. To save money, my summary slide is my intro slide. Thank you very much.
Maybe a quick question or two.
So what's the most promising quantum computer in practice?
Well, 3 times 15 is pretty hardcore. So there's a lot of different candidates, or a lot of different systems used. So people use NMR quantum computation, where they're computing with the nuclear magnetic spins of the nuclei in certain molecules. They compute with ion traps, where they just have a bunch of ions in a row in a laser cooled trap. They compute with neutral atoms in a lattice. Compute with photons just by setting up an optical array and just sending the photons through and letting letting them do the computation as they fly. There are lots of different schemes. All of them have drawbacks. Essentially, there's a trade-off. What you want from quantum systems is systems qubits you can protect very easily from noise and operations, but at the same time, qubits that you can very easily operate on, so you can do all these gates. And one of those things is making them inaccessible. One of those things is making them accessible. So it's kind of tricky to do both at the same time. There's a lot of work on topological qubits now, where the qubit itself, the quantum information, is stored in a topological feature of some system. The idea between that being, so long as this is a topological feature, we can access fairly reliably. It's actually very hard for random cosmic rays and such like to twig. But what we want is not just them to scatter off our qubit, but to actually rotate it around some kind of circuit. It kind of moves our qubit into a physical subspace that's actually protected from the kind of stuff that goes on in the environment. So that's kind of promising. But all of them are very tentative at the moment. I mean, in the long run, the best guess, I guess, is that some as yet unknown solid-state condensed matter technology would be ideal. Because at the moment, most of the options are very hard to scale.
So let's break up for coffee and get meet at 10 past 11.